Here at Yours, Mine and Femme, we acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land of which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation.
We pay respects to the elders past and present, always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Tuned into 2SER 107.3 FM, and this is Yours, Mine and Femme, a show where we explore femininity outside of the patriarchy. We're your hosts, Beth Tracy and the wondrous goddess that is Bella Michi. Belle, how are you?
Oh, not bad, Beth. What a lovely introduction there.
Thought it was fitting.
Aw, bless ya. But hey, speaking of goddesses, this week we're exploring the wonder that is birth. Now, birth is one of the miracles that people with uteruses can perform. And whilst this should be a joyous occasion, for some First Nations people compared to non-Indigenous people, this is not the case.
Exactly right, Belle. That's what we're going to be exploring today, the gap between First Nations and non-Indigenous prenatal and antenatal healthcare. It's not only a gap, but it's really a horrific chasm. Maternal deaths for First Nations mothers are 3.7 times higher than for other Australian women, and perinatal deaths are twice as high. Preterm birth actually being the largest contributing factor to infant and child mortality, with those preterm birth rates being at 1.7 times higher for First Nations babies. And it's even higher in the top end of the Northern Territory, where 1 in 5 babies are born prematurely.
Beth and I spoke with two experts on this very topic, Professor Catherine Chamberlain, who breaks down the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous mothers in birthing aftercare, as well as Dr. Yvette Rowe, who is advocating for birthing on country services that reintegrate traditional Indigenous birthing methods and wisdom with modern Western science. So make sure you stick with us for the next hour.
And as always, we'll be featuring some amazing music on the show, with this episode exclusively celebrating feminine identifying Indigenous artists, like this amazing artist, Electric Fields.
Okay, I remember when we were little, we would hear, "Chichichuta in Makwaya Pakala." That would be the grandmothers and the grandfathers.
This is Emma.
Like, oh, you guys got to get up and dance, okay? Now we got to do the traditional dance. And if we didn't get it right, our grandmothers and grandfathers would be like, "Oh, chichichuta liprala in Makwaya Pakala, alaji, alaji." Meaning, you gotta do it like this. You gotta do it like this. And when you'd hear, that's when you knew they would be very proud of what you did.
Alati,
tuned into YMF with Beth and Bell on 2SER. We're exploring the gap in perinatal care between First Nations mothers and non-Indigenous mothers.
While Australia is one of the safest places in the world to give birth, First Nations women are 3 times more likely to die in childbirth than other Australian women. I spoke to Professor Catherine Chamberlain, a proud Palawa Trawlaway woman, about the causes behind this disparity.
So with your new research, tell me all the findings in terms of the gaps in healthcare between Indigenous and non-Indigenous women.
Gosh, that is a big question. I'm a public health researcher, so the primary focus of the research that I've been working on for the past 4 years has been working with community organisation partners and communities to co-design strategies to address intergenerational trauma and complex trauma impacting on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families. There's lots of findings available on our website, but a key finding is that this time during pregnancy, birth, and the first few years after birth is a really critical life course opportunity for transforming intergenerational cycles of hurt and trauma into positively reinforcing cycles of nurturing and recovery. And this is a really critical foundation to closing the gap. So there's 3 main reasons why it's really important at this time. It's a time when people are more likely to experience trauma-related distress and triggering of those fight, flight, and freeze responses due to lots of reasons, including the intimate nature of care during pregnancy, birth, and early childhood. There's hormonal changes that happen at that time, sleep deprivation, higher risk of mental illness. People can have pre-existing birth trauma, financial pressures, and all the other things that we know can happen at that time. Despite all of those risks, there's really clear evidence from longitudinal studies of people who have experienced severe trauma, such as youth in detention centres, that this more people recover and experience post-traumatic growth and positive change at this time than at any other time during their life. And this is thought to be due to lots of positive things that happen at that time, the natural bonding with all the love that baby brings into the world with them, which facilitates that sort of cycles of recovery or earned security and help to rewire those, you know, fear and trauma responses. That's why the work that we do, we call it healing the past by nurturing the future, because that's, you know, what we're really trying to do. And the other thing is, of course, at this time, it's generally the first time since childhood that most people have contact with health services. So it's a really, and we see people a lot, so we want to make sure that those experiences are positive and safe. So really focusing on safe, you know, trauma integrated care. So we're integrating that work at the moment with all the other work that's been known by other researchers around the world around the importance of continuity of care and of having a known midwife with another program that we're working on called Replanting the Birthing Trees and Culturally Safe Care.
In regards to the gap between that you guys speak about, you know, between Indigenous and non-Indigenous women, one of the factors that you mentioned in your article is how pregnant First Nations women avoiding antenatal care for fear of child protection services taking their children. And you say this is a legacy of the stolen generations with, as we see, the continuing high rates of child removals. I'd actually spoken about this fear amongst First Nations women when we were covering a different aspect when it came to gender-based violence, and it's just incredible how much this has, you know, impacted people of this community. Can you elaborate on that aspect and how this has affected, as you guys mentioned, antenatal care?
Absolutely. Well, you know, as a parent myself, it's just hard to imagine anything more terrifying than having your child taken away and removed. Yet this is what's happened for thousands of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families. It's been horrific everywhere, but particularly, you know, in the southeastern part of Australia. Down here, we've got to remember that nearly 1/3 of all registered Aboriginal people in the southeastern part of Australia were living in settlements as recently as 1961. So that's within living memory for a lot of us. And, you know, the threat of removal was ever present, and it was used by the state as a weapon of genocide, effectively. So, you know, people had the threat of having their child removed if they spoke in language, if children were assessed as having lighter skin and they could be taken away from the communities or the settlement, if people breached the rules. So some of the rules at those times during the settlements is that people were given permission to leave the settlements if they, you know, followed the rules of not contacting people back in, you know, breaking those bonds with their communities and their families. So if people did make contact, they could lose, you know, again, that threat could be that they weren't provided providing the appropriate environment for their child, and again, they could have their child removed. So a lot of this was happened also within maternity care services, often from the removal of children might happen in hospitals shortly after birth, and it's still happening today, and with sometimes without prior warning, so there could be a notification to child protection services. Parents don't know that that notification's been made, and there can be an order made for the child to be removed without the parent's knowledge. So with that happening, even if it's happening once in a blue moon, it's still the worry. Imagine the terror of being an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person in a maternity service, wondering if that might have happened without your knowledge, and knowing that that has happened so many times and your grandmother talks about it. It's happened to your great-grandmother. So this is something that is real. You know, it's a live issue for us in our communities, and it's something that we need to be really mindful of when what people are, a lot of people are thinking about when they're coming in for pregnancy care.
Some very illuminating and interesting points there from Professor Chamberlain. Look, we're going to go to a track now before we continue on with our conversation with Professor Chamberlain. This one's from Pyrrha featuring Dirty Vegas. It's Days Go By.
We hope. Jane Amma.
Such a good track there. That was from Emily Waramara, Naraku Jinama, right there for you. And Belle, what are we continuing on with?
Well, Beth, in the second half of my chat with Professor Chamberlain, we explore the value of integrating these traditional Indigenous medical practices, as well as the importance of having First Nations nurses and midwives available.
I just want to ask you about what kind of, I suppose, damage would you say that we've seen from this prioritizing of Western medicine and framing it as more legitimate than the holistic methods used traditionally by First Nations people? And, you know, how has the colonial mindset at forcing, you know, these Western ways onto new mothers impacted them?
I think it's really important. I mean, one of the central hallmarks of maternity care and the goals has really been of all the maternity care policies around Australia has been around in recent decades around women-centred care and enabling choice and control. That's really been critical. However, the Western birthing methods that have been available have been developed and dominated by medical obstetrics. And until recently, that's largely been men that have been in charge of all of that. And so women, there has been a movement since the women's movement to try and put the women's experiences and women's priorities more central to that and to really focus on women-centred care, addressing women's needs and giving women choice and control. And that's really occurred alongside the broader women's rights movements across Australia. But in terms of First Nations women's needs, we're really still at the starting blocks with that. You know, we're really just trying to get that started now with the movements around birthing on country that Yvette Rowe and Sue Kilday and others have been leading, and really more broadly trying to consider the needs of First Nations women during pregnancy and birth. And I think, you know, one of the things, just to give this some context, it's important to remember that at the time of colonisation, First Nations, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander First Nations people were healthier than non-Indigenous people in Europe and children at the time, and certainly than the people that arrived here in Australia. And this didn't happen by accident. It was due to these holistic practices that were developed over millennia that started before birth. So these things happen before the baby's born and continue all throughout life until after death. And these were practices that were centred around fostering really good social, emotional and physical well-being. And becoming a parent, it's not just a medical procedure. It's obstetrics is really important. And the life-saving advances that have been made in obstetrics are important advances. But with that, we don't want to be losing those important elements of social, emotional well-being. It's not an either or. We can have both and. This transition to becoming a parent, it's a transition to the most important responsibility that any of us as human beings have. No matter what job people have, I think everyone would agree that the most important job and the most important achievement that all of us have in our life is caring for our children. So we're supporting people through that really critical transition. And so that is not just about being physically healthy, but also emotionally healthy and socially getting the support that you need. So all of that has been disrupted with colonisation, and the Western methods just haven't even addressed those kind of things. So we are now at a stage of learning from our elders that still remember and practice those things, and we really need to try and build that into our Western healthcare systems. And I think this is a huge opportunity for all of our healthcare systems, because why wouldn't you take advantage of all of that knowledge and enriching opportunities that we have, and to give people more choice and understanding of that?
Oh no, without doubt. Just to continue on that thought, what kind of difference does it make to First Nations mothers when to having a a midwife or nurse who's from their community, who has that cultural understanding and can bring that knowledge, as you mentioned, to help guide them through the childbirth process.
I think having First Nations midwives has a lot of benefits. So as you say, immediately for mothers coming in, seeing somebody that is hopefully they feel less fearful of, that they feel safer with, is really important. And also being able to tap into that millennia of knowledge that we just talked about previously. I also think more broadly, I mean, there's some studies showing it's still important to go back to the principle of choice. So not all women will choose, will want to have a First Nations midwife. They might know other midwives and build relationships with other midwives that they prefer. So it's having that principle of choice, I think, is the really, really critical element. But saying that, having First Nations midwives working in the system as an option is really, really important for women. And I also think that having First Nations midwives in the system, seeing some of the challenges in the system, can help to change the system. It can also help to improve the understanding for non-Indigenous colleagues working to improve their knowledge and improve the sort of structural competence of the healthcare organisation, you know, the cultural safety more broadly, if organisations can work with First Nations midwives to so that they're working with the system, not having to constantly fight against it every day, you know, coming to work, which can, you know, lead to moral injury and for the midwives themselves if they're working in an unsafe environment.
Just to wrap things up, you know, you've mentioned the benefits of First Nations nurses and midwives. However, currently they represent 1.1% of the workforce in that industry. What needs to be done so we can kind of close this gap and, you know, get more people into that field?
Well, if there's any First Nations midwives or women out there, or men, because both now, I would say, you know, this is just the best job to do. And it really is the most rewarding, incredibly fantastic job. So give it a go. I think there's that element of you can't be what you can't see as well. And we're starting to, I think, really increasing the visibility of First Nations midwives and the critical role that they have in the sector will hopefully help inspire people to take up that role. I think universities and organisations, healthcare organisations, need to work together to ensure that they're working in a way that's culturally safe. There's lots of reports out there with strategies to attract First Nations people to it. Katzenham have got the Getting Them and Keeping Them report that's out there. There's lots of scholarship opportunities. I think it's really important for organisations to be able to provide support and to enable, have their models of care so that midwives, First Nations midwives, are able to actually provide the kind of care that women want, so that they're working with the system, not against the system, and able to provide high quality responsive care. And I think the other thing that we didn't talk about in the paper, but I think would be kind of interesting to explore, in traditionally what we've always had in midwifery is mentoring models. So where you identify women that are interested in taking up midwifery, and then they work with a mentor that takes them through to develop technical expertise around this area, but also emotional expertise and taking on additional responsibility when they're ready. And then gradually, you know, traditionally in a lot of countries, midwives are referred to as the wise women, and it's that kind of model of developing that technical and emotional expertise that leads to wisdom. And I think if we could have some more support for midwives going through to develop up, help you support families, particularly parents experiencing complex trauma and other complex issues. And, you know, we definitely need more of those wise women and men, you know, working, using these fantastic opportunities that we have at the time to support families to transform, you know, those cycles of trauma into those cycles of nurturing and recovery and healing, and to have the happy, healthy lives that they and their children, you know, want to have and deserve. So I think there's lots of opportunities there, and now's a great time to be able to do this.
Beth and I will be giving our thoughts on what we've just heard from Professor Chamberlain at the end of the show, but for now we're going to hear a track from the icon that is Emma Donovan with My Dreaming Place.
When I wake up from sleeping, when I can sing out the day, how ancestors are watching to guide me through today. I walk out the door with my feet, but when I look back, I know there's more than just my footprints, and I have a place to go. It's my dreaming. I can dance up when I go out walking on country. Elders and totems teach me this is my dream and play. We will always be connected.
Listening to Yours, Mine and Femme on 2SER 107.3. And look, if you've just tuned in, we're exploring the gap between the perinatal care of First Nations mothers and non-Indigenous mothers. We've just heard from Professor Catherine Chamberlain, who took us through the factors that contribute to this disparity. And I caught up with Dr. Yvette Rowe, whom Catherine actually mentioned in her talk with Belle. Dr. Yvette Rowe actually advocates and researches the benefits of birthing on country services for First Nations mothers. Take a listen. Now, first off, Yvette, for our listeners who aren't familiar with the term, could you please break down what birthing on country means and how birthing on country services first began and why they are so important?
When you break it down, it's a really basic concept. There's a lot of mythology around it. At the core of birthing on country is ensuring that First Nation babies receive cultural and clinically excellent care, which includes cultural consideration, clinical excellence in a place where mum and baby feel really safe. And, you know, sometimes people get a bit scared that, you know, it's women birthing by themselves in a remote area under a bush, and it's far from that. You know, one of the things about birthing on country is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have never ceded their sovereignty over the land. So everywhere in Australia is First Nation land. So when we talk about birthing on country, you could be in the middle of Brisbane, Sydney, or right out back at Kalgoorlie, it's still First Nation land. So like I said, when we look to the core of it, it's giving baby the best start in life that takes into consideration clinical considerations and cultural framework to hold mother and baby so the system can wrap their arms around them.
Brilliant. And it's obviously, it's so needed. The gap between First Nations women's prenatal and antenatal healthcare and non-Indigenous women's healthcare is staggering. You know, earlier this morning, I looked up, obviously I was researching, and the statistics I came across really rocked me to my core. And I would just like to take a moment to bring them to light here for a moment. Maternal death for First Nations mothers is 3.7 times higher than for other Australian women. And perinatal deaths are twice as high. Preterm birth being actually the largest contributing factor to infant and child mortality, with those preterm birth rates being at 1.7 times higher for First Nations babies. And it's even higher in the top end of the Northern Territory, where 1 in 5 babies are born prematurely. Now, Yvette, you know, that's in your neck of the woods. You're up in Darwin. Why is this the case? And what factors are really at play here, you know, besides racial bias, if you can even talk on that as well?
Yeah, this is a really complex matter, and there's a whole range of things that lead up to it. So the impact of, you know, colonisation has really disrupted a lot of traditional birthing practices in First Nation communities. And when you've disrupted knowledge systems and you've had colonial institutionalised or Western medical model systems imposed on people, where it's a racist system, it's not culturally safe. You have people who cannot communicate in the system, especially in the Northern Territory, where English might be someone's, you know, sixth or seventh language. Mm. The issue is, if that's the case, how do you get consent when your clinicians all speak English? Mm. We also have this stuff of a lot of the issues surrounding mothers and babies is outside the health sector. One of the alarming issues in our communities through across Australia is the housing shortage. And we've got lots of families sharing together. We've got unstable housing. We've got food insecurity. So often the health system is dealing with the symptoms of a broader system which has failed to uplift and to ensure that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people can thrive. So it's really complex. But what you're saying is really important. When we're talking about babies that are born too early and too small, which is what we call as preterm births, those babies start struggling before they come into the world. They've got more chances of having cerebral palsy, developmental problems, heart disease, respiratory illness, learning ability. So when you think about that starting line, they're already behind the starting line. Mm. And then if you don't have a system that can support mother and baby, whether it's postnatal care, if it's housing and infrastructure, whether it's food security, those struggles get compounded and compounded. You know, both urban and very remote communities have very similar access issues. So it is that stuff of not every baby in Australia is born with the same life chance. And so we need to have considerations in our system as about for the people that need extra support, what do we need to do to uplift them to support mum and baby? And birthing and pregnancy is one stage. Mm. Parenting and being the best parent you can do to support that baby through its life cycle is another stage. And what we find is often systems are very siloed. You know, we have a birthing system that's not connected to the education system, that's not connected to employment or housing. So we have a fragmented system that actually excludes First Nation people. And what we see in the data is a whole range of inequities, which are systematic and they're structural. And what happens is you get these illusion that we've all got the same equal chance, but actually most people don't. So we need to, again, remove that mythology and look out in the, you know, to revise a system that how do we give people who need extra assistance, extra support? You know, if we're talking about a society that wants equality and equity, we've got to work out and target the areas that there's huge inequalities.
Most definitely. And, you know, I also saw that government policy has seen, you know, the closure of many maternity services across regional and remote Australia, which, you know, obviously would have exacerbated this issue even further and resulted in an obviously inequitable service distribution across Australia as a whole. How do birthing on country services combat this? You know, I've also read about something called the RISE framework. What is RISE and is it the key to closing this gap?
So if we were to look at, again, in remote areas in the Northern Territory, close to 20, 30 years ago, you would have midwives and nurses in all our remote community. So you talked about the issue of what does our workforce look like? Those clinics have been shrunk. So often we don't have midwives in there. You have nurses working in very resource poor environments doing the best they can. Nurses are very different to midwives. And so we actually haven't got the workforce to support pregnant and young mums and things like that. And so A, we don't have the workforce. We've got an aging workforce where people do their time in remote areas and they want to retire. So when we look at the pathway to recruiting midwives that want to go into remote areas, there's a certain skill set. And we need to make sure we've got our best clinicians doing amazing jobs that are also culturally safe. So workforce is our biggest investment. A health service can spend 70% of its budget on its workforce. So getting that combination about the right skill for the right place, working with the right people in a culturally safe setting is so important. The other thing is, we've got to make sure that the service that we're providing is responsive to the community. You know, you can have the best service that's got bells and whistles, but if people aren't accessing in a way that suits them, we need to think about actually the current system as a whole isn't doing all the things it could. So we have to be a bit clever and innovative about how we design it. So going back to the system is shrinking. We've got a workforce that is not up to what we need, but also it's resource poor. There's people in our communities and clinicians that are doing an amazing job on a shoestring budget. But also there's a lot, like I said, a lot of the considerations in maternity and birthing, there's strains and stresses that are outside our control. Housing, you know, nutrition, food insecurity. So with all these problems, there's really innovative solutions that come. And one of the things is with all these solutions, what's the best way to be sort of approach it? We need a plan. So we've come up with the RISE framework, which is R stands for redesigning the existing maternity service. What does that look like? Is it the best way that could be run? The I stands for investing in the workforce, which was what you were talking about. How do we ensure that you know, Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, you know, whether they're going into midwifery, family support care, whether they're paediatricians, how do we ensure that we've got a workforce that is clinically and culturally exceptional? Close enough is not good enough. We need to ensure that all Australians have the best health service. S is about strengthening family capacity. We know that in some of our communities, they're doing amazing stuff. Families are really strong. But we also know in some of our communities, there are families that need support, whether that be issues about violence or food security, overcrowding, engagement in health systems. So we know there's families that need that support. Like I said, you know, pregnancy, it can't go more than 10 months, but parenting lasts a lifetime. So how do we ensure that, you know, parenting and families' capacity can be supported? And that includes things like language revitalization in remote communities, in cultural practices. About one of the things that's often overlooked is about the role of dads in our communities. Mm. Some of our communities, yeah, dads have been demonized, but we know that dads have a really important place. We've got, you know, stuff in our communities where, you know, people are sort of absent because of, you know, drugs and substance misuse. And that was sort of lands on the shoulders of grandparents. But they're a community that are really holding up their community and supporting each other. Also, the other evidence that we know is the E. How do we engage and empower our communities to realise this is something they can contribute to? Community control is, you know, we know the evidence works. When community are part of a process where they feel they own the service, you actually get better outcomes. So the RISE model, the RISE, allows us to actually transform or translate a system that actually can have long-term benefit for mother, child and family.
We're going to take a break right now and continue on listening to my conversation with Dr. Yvette Rowe. But right now we're going to listen to a track from Nya with Closer. In the summer, eat you on a corner street, sweat on your shoulders, tomorrow. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Yours, Mine and Femme with Beth and Bell, and we're continuing on with my conversation with Dr. Yvette Rowe, who has just outlined the RISE framework that is vital to the functionings of birthing and country services. In this portion of our talk, we dissect what this framework has accomplished thus far and what else we need to do to close this gap in perinatal healthcare for good. That entire framework sounds magnificent and exactly the sort of thinking that we need to be invoking to deal with this situation. And, you know, one example or exemplar example of using the RISE framework, and especially that E, you know, incorporating, encouraging the community to be a part of this framework, is the Caring for Mum on Country project, which is, you know, a community-driven action research project piloting doula training and exploring reproductive health literacy, specifically within the Yolongu community of Northeast Arnhem Land. It's really an amazing demonstration of birthing on country maternity service, so much so that there's actually a documentary that was even made about the workforce of skilled Yolongu Jakamirs, the cultural caretakers of pregnancy and birth. Yvette, could you take us through what made this project so successful?
First of all, I've got to acknowledge the outstanding leadership of Professor Laupa Maipalama from Galawinka community. Her vision and her passion to improve the outcomes for her community of Galawinku has really driven this. And one of the things that she was very clear about was our women, we want them that when they're connected to country and are practicing, you know, their culture, they're more likely to have support around them. They're more likely to have better outcomes because often in remote communities, they're getting sent away to Nullumboy, Darwin, or if baby's really sick, to Adelaide at 36 weeks, putting stresses and strain on mother and family and things like that. And one of her concerns was this disconnect of young women being taken away from the island and not to be able to practice their traditional birthing practices. So when we talk about caring for mum and country, it's going back to that stuff of ensuring that people have the cultural framework and the traditional birthing practices. And if you think about 60,000 years of occupation, Aboriginal people are very clever. You know, they were traditional midwives. They were able to, you know, support each other as women. They were able to turn baby. And the connection to country and their cultural practice, the country looked after them. But now, you know, one of the things for Galawinku is that we now have this Western biomedical system imposed on women that says this is how the system works. And when English isn't your first language, where you have people poking and prodding you and you don't have any understanding what's going on, how can women have agency in that system?
Definitely. I was just going to ask about
that. Larapa was very clear is that we need to make sure in Galawinku that the Jakamirs, the birthing and pregnancy companions who would be recruited from that community, would be an advocate, a support person, someone who would be part of a cultural connection, but could help the woman. Remember, they're not clinicians, they're cultural practices, and can walk with that woman in a very Western biomedical model. And some of the stories that we're hearing back is it's been an outstanding success, both from the clinical perspective and also from health outcomes. So Larapa is really, you know, so passionate. Again, it's the whole stuff is that we need to ensure when we talk about the workforce that Aboriginal health is in Aboriginal hands. And in Galawinku, you know, situation, Jakamir are taking their traditional role as the birthing companion to support women in a very Western biomedical model.
That's fantastic. And finally, since, you know, birthing on country services have intervened and been established, have we seen this gap closing at all? And what work still remains for us to do to completely close this gap for good?
I think, I'm a researcher who's into redesigning health services. And we've been building on evidence for the last 25 years. This wasn't an idea that sort of turned up last week and let's give it a go. So, you know, we've been fortunate to build up on this evidence for 25 years. And I want to give a special acknowledgement to the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health, the Brisbane Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Community Health Service, and Mater Hospital, who has actually led some amazing research, which in a urban setting where they had a birthing in our community service, and we compared it to the mainstream service. So the birthing in our community had some key elements. They had governance between the Mater Hospital, the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health, and Brisbane AICS, and they had a governance model, and they oversaw it. They had a midwife who was attached to the women who were having First Nation babies. They had a model of midwifery group practice, so the midwife was working with the woman the whole time. They also had a family support worker. They had a mums and bubs hub, which was outside the hospital. And the women will also network into a primary healthcare service. So when we look, which is very different to what we see normally. And so this was very much driven by the community. And so the evidence, after a year, we saw results that we've never seen in Australia. We saw the reduction of preterm births. Again, those babies that were too small and born too early. That had been reduced by 37%.
Wow.
That is, yeah, and that was published in The Lancet. Goodness. We saw all the other beautiful indicators that said that mum was thriving. So one of the things was that we saw more mothers going to the midwife to do antenatal care more often, which then created a space of trust, but you were able to do some opportunistic interventions if that was required. You also had the midwives and the family support worker wrapping their arms around the mum. So there's a certain things that the midwife can do regarding her, you know, how mum's pregnancy is progressing. But also the family support worker was an advocate chasing up things like payments from Centrelink, housing disruptions, a whole range of things. And also the women had access to a primary healthcare provider who could then refer them on to a whole range of services. We saw that women were more likely to breastfeed, which is, you know, we know that breast is best for baby. Mm-hmm. Women were less likely to have a clinical intervention during namely seizures. So we had more women who are, you know, having healthy births. So we saw all these things that said, yes, yes, we can do this. So the key stuff was we've got evidence in an urban setting. The thing for researchers using the RISE framework is how do we do that in a very remote setting? Because the evidence says we can make a huge difference. Mm. Can we close the gap? I always laugh at this because it's not a gap, it's a chasm. Mm. Because it's so huge.
Yeah.
Because you're assuming that non-Indigenous people's life expectancy is not going to increase. So if we're closing our gap, we're assuming they're going to get healthier. So it's a misnomer. What we want is that we want to give First Nation babies the best start to life. We want them to come into the world strong, healthy, supported by a system that actually upholds them, that is, you know, supported within not only a clinical framework, but a cultural framework. And we're really excited. So when we talk about, you know, the stuff that's happening in Galawinku with regarding the Jackamers, that's a community-driven initiative. And there's so many moving parts. But we know that the evidence that we've learned from Southeast Queensland is, yeah, we can do this. It's going to take a lot of work. But where we are now, when one in five of those babies are so small and so sick, we have a responsibility and an urgency to change this now. As it said, as Professor Sue Kilday says in the Jackamere documentary, birthing is a human right. And us as Australians have a responsibility to change the outcomes.
Wow. Okay. A lot to unpack. Belle and I will come back with our thoughts after this track from Misha. This is Black Privilege.
They're still waiting on me. And before they have asked my name, it's seven skin like armor. Thick enough to hold the pain. It's the way that it's grief. Made me stronger till I cannot breathe. And got a cheaper price on stolen goods on claim. Funny when I lose you, keep on complaining. Then write the new rules just to be bent on breaking. Told me that I choose the news that you've been making. Then I need to prove I'm worthy of deceiving. It's hard away my birthday. That you don't know exist. How somebody forget what the other don't admit. Tell me how to explain what you were taught to forget. How the wounds gonna heal when the tides ain't over yet. Funny when I lose you, keep on complaining. Then write the new rules just to be bent on breaking. My bed.
listening to Yours, Mine and Femme, and this episode we've been exploring the disparity in perinatal healthcare between First Nations and non-Indigenous Australians, as well as exploring birthing on country services with Professor Catherine Chamberlain and Dr. Yvette Rowe. Bella, what are your takeaways from what we've heard this episode?
So regarding my chat with Professor Chamberlain, one of the most jarring influences she mentioned was the impact of the stolen generations. Now, as I mentioned in my chat, I had heard about one of the consequences of those awful government policies is that it instilled a fear between Aboriginal communities and getting in contact with non-Indigenous folks and authorities. And we've seen the devastating effects of this residual distrust of government authorities impact how Aboriginal people are resistant to reach out when experiencing family violence, for example. And similarly, as Professor Chamberlain mentioned, they are hesitant to receive antenatal care because of the fear of losing their children. And I don't know about you listening at home, whether you're aware of that fallout of the stolen generations is still being seen today over 50 years on. And it's just heartbreaking. However, like Professor Chamberlain said, it's still happening today, the high rates of child removals. So at the end of the day, I can kind of understand the distrust there.
I completely understand the distrust there. That's the biggest takeaway that I've taken from your chat with Professor Chamberlain, Bella. You know, that impact of the stolen generation will forever echo within the communities of First Nations peoples. As Catherine said, you know, a third of all registered Aboriginal people in the southeastern part of Australia were living in settlements as recently as 1962. And in those settlements, breaking bonds with their family and their communities was celebrated. You know, it was rewarded. So it's obvious that those deep-rooted traumas would be passed down generations, and as we've seen, directly impact not only First Nations birthing experiences, but the most imperative time of a child's development, you know, those first few years of life. And in my conversation with Dr. Yvette Rowe, she echoed those same issues and even brought forward other factors that are impacting First Nations birthing, such as housing, regional access to healthcare, poverty, food shortages, and so on. You know, if these issues are not stopped dead in their tracks, this cycle of intergenerational trauma is just going to continue, and it's a horrific cycle.
Yeah, you've made an excellent point there, Beth. And also, whilst I haven't birthed a child myself, at least not yet.
Neither have I. Keep that in mind as you're listening.
I think we forget how traumatic labour is. Some of the stories I hear are just shocking. Mm. And as was mentioned, it can trigger those flight or flight reactions. So making sure the mother is receiving the best care with someone she is comfortable with is the most important. And this is why we really need to incentivize joining the nursing and midwife industry. As Yvette mentioned, we have an aging workforce, which is honestly a really scary thought because one workforce that should not be working short staff is nurses and midwives. So we really need to work on closing that gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous healthcare workers. As well as both Yvette and Catherine have mentioned that Aboriginal people were occupying this land for tens of thousands of years. They have crafted these holistic practices over all that time. And when the Europeans came here, Aboriginal people were actually healthier than them. We need to stop this tunnel vision when it comes to healthcare and the idea of only valuing these Western biomedical systems. As Yvette mentioned, the hard evidence shows that having these cultural practices in place is key to closing that gap in birthing care.
Exactly. And, you know, like you said, Bella, First Nations peoples have over 60,000 years of highly intelligent, holistically cultural and medical practices that they've had in place for bloody millennia. And bringing First Nations mothers into a solely Western medical space, which one, is structurally racist, two, does not understand their culture, and three, only speaks English, you know, regardless of the fact that that First Nations mother that's come in probably speaks eight other languages, it's a really isolating and dehumanizing experience. So as you said, Belle, this is why that RISE framework that Yvette had, you know, produced with child birthing services is so integral to closing this gap. And bringing Indigenous peoples into the healthcare system is imperative. You know, as Yvette told us, we've seen that in action with amazing results in the Yolngu community of Northeast Arnhem Land with their work with the Jakamirs, you know, the traditional midwives of the community. At the end of the day, I think closing this gap comes down to the quote that Yvette relayed to me at the very end of our conversation from Sue Kilde, as she said it in the Jakamir documentary. She said that birthing is a human right, and as Australians, we have a responsibility to change the outcomes. It's about protecting all Australian life, Indigenous, non-Indigenous, and giving all of these services that we can possibly muster that are going to benefit and protect these birthing experiences and the aftercare of birthing to be better.
Absolutely. That quote from Sue really does just
summarize what we
encapsulates
exactly
everything on this topic. Well, that's all from us here today. Massive thanks to Professor Catherine Chamberlain and Dr. Yvette Rowe for chatting with us here today.
Let us know your thoughts on the episode and give us a follow on Instagram and Twitter at YMF_2SER. We are your hosts, Beth Tracy, and as I said at the beginning, the goddess, that is Bella Michie. We'll be back next week on Monday. We'll hope you have a good week. See you then.
See ya.